You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
We are under the banner of heaven on Post Show Recap. My name is Grace. I'm here with my co-host, the one and only, DM Philly. Philly, how you doing?
I'm so good, Grace. I am so excited to be back with you under the banner of heaven.
Are you a wheat or a tear, Philly? This is the question of the day.
A tear, yeah.
I think I'm a tear, too. I don't think I'm wheat at all.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Good episode, I thought. Episode 3, Surrender. Mostly the cabin shootout. We get some more of Sam, the titular McCulkin in the show. Yeah, I thought a good episode.
I thought it was an excellent episode. I think we've had this like rising tension. We have been building to this crescendo here, getting to know our characters, setting the stage. We left on like this big cliffhanger, and I thought that we come back interestingly, but the tension was not as like action-packed as it might have like led you to believe it was going to be by the end of episode 2. But I did think it was really good. Now we're getting into the proper of like the conflict, the heart and soul of like what's really going on with the Lafferty's and like the deep levels of dysfunction that we're kind of exploring here.
I'm a big fan. I like to be on the IMDb and the wiki, spoilers, whatever, come at me. And the episode picture on IMDb for episode 3 is this full on like behind the car shootout. And I thought that was like the tension of the episode was going to be like full on shootout. It's barely a shootout. But like, I thought, you know, if that's not what the episode was, it had lots of tension and kind of the tension that I like more, which is all character tension, you know.
I fully agree. Yeah, I mean, I think, look, as we're like recounting this real story to an extent, there's only like so much room for explosive drama, right? Or we would probably be a little bit more familiar with like the telling of this tale if it were this like insane amount of high violence. So I don't know, charming would be the wrong word for it, but it's very like compelling, right? In that like it is real, it feels real in the way that like it's unfolding and this thing is burning out as we're starting to get into like the revelations here that like all of this evolved out of this resistance for like traffic tickets and like simple like, you know, bureaucratic administrative fees and fines and taxes has like evolved into this kind of course into this fundamentalist radicalization of this family is like kind of hardcore, right? And very compelling. Yeah.
The my one, I think, minor critique of the show so far, and it's super minor, because I think the whatever is the A storyline of each of these episodes, which is basically Jeb solving the murder, and then anything that's like digging into Lafferty background stuff, I love. I think it's like really, really good. And then I think that like the Jeb home life stuff is a little bit weaker. It's not even bad. It's just not as good as the other stuff. And then I think the most like I'm like, all right, I got to like watch through this because they're trying to do a thing is all the like super flashbacks, like the 1800s flashbacks. It would be my like one critique of the show. Totally fine. I'm not like, it's not skippable. It's not, I don't even think it's boring. It's just not as good as the other stuff. I think like Garfield is really, this episode in particular, Garfield and then the character who plays Bill, I just think are like tremendous, tremendous actors.
No, I absolutely agree. Gil Birmingham there, right? Yeah. We talked about it a lot, but the vibe between these two is just like electric. They have such energy. That like scene as they're sitting behind the shed, like, it's oh, so I took good. My boot off. You never take your boot off, Boy Scout, Eagle
he's
Scout, actually.
Eating you know? Gum, he's chewing gum. Yeah. It's so good. It's like, just what, like, you have a really? Cigarette?
Really? You know, they have a terrific kind of energy together. And I think to that point, when you're putting them with all the rest of our ensemble here, as we're like engaging with the rest of the Lafferty's, everybody that's like becoming involved, they're excellent. And it's excellent. Right. And the delving into the Lafferty's, I think like all the Lafferty brothers, the Lafferty family, this stuff is great. I think my issue with like the pacing of Garfield's like home life it's about pacing. I don't think that it's like, to your point, it's not bad or boring, but like it's kind of a foregone conclusion, right? The second we like turn the show on, we know like, okay, this guy's gonna have a crisis of faith, right? And and it feels a little bit like going through the motions, like we haven't spent enough time there to feel like deeply invested in it. But at the same time, like I don't want to spend that much more time there. Like everything else is kind of like more engaging, so it's just like happening right in the background. And I think that his poor wife feels like, you know, it's tough because you have like empathy for this character, but at the same time, she's very underdeveloped. We haven't spent a lot of time with her, and she's towing the line of like the antagonists of our story, right? As like Garfield is going through this very compelling reflection on his devotion to his faith and how dangerous that can be, and like what his faith is and what he doesn't know about it and who is he supporting, right? So it just feels a little undercooked. Right.
I would agree.
And the flashback stuff, I think, is like, I'm really glad it's there to have this view back into Mormonism as somebody that's like stepping into the show from the outside. Mm-hmm. But it does feel like, you know, like a YouTube fan made period piece that's being kind of crowbarred into the middle of like this mainstream television show. Right. Just tonally, it's jarring. Right.
Yeah.
And like,
I would agree. Okay, but I think everything else it's working, and even the stuff I think that's not working is still kind of working, just not as well as the main stuff, which I think is like supremely good. So let's jump into the episode. We see Jeb's mom watching the kids play outside in their basement bedroom, and then we see Jeb driving. He is following Bill's call for backup. And we also discover that Alan has a police record, and he actually got arrested the day after his wedding. This is some new information that they've uncovered about Alan, which seems a little bit suspicious. Jeb and the other police find Bill's car. They put on bulletproof vests and head into the woods to follow after to try and find Bill. They find a bag of blueberries and they hear the rattling again, which is so unnerving. And we hear these people yelling, "You have no authority here. We will defend our private property." So tense start to the episode.
The rattling is terrifying. This whole vibe in the woods is like absolutely overwhelming. And this poor little deputy in the car with Garfield, I keep like forgetting his name, but he so perfectly captures this like innocent, naive, blind youth who's kind of like overwhelmed with the, you know, as Garfield is like being forced to wrestle with these questions maybe that he's had on the shelf for a long time or whatever, right? The vibe with these guys is great. And
I believe this is Officer Morris.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you. I just was like looking it up frantically. Mm-hmm. But the whole, just the filming of the scene, right? As Jeb is like closing in and like coming into the space, getting the like the bulletproof vest, like it all is so tense and visceral, right? It captures that like frantic heart rate horror movie energy, you know?
Yeah, finding the car that's been deserted, like terrifying.
The handprints and the dust, right? Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And so this dog sort of charges at Jeb, but it's on the leash, so he's able to like stay far enough back. And he heads around the side of this little shed type thing and actually finds Bill. And they call for backup, but it'll take about 40 minutes. And this is where Bill just starts singing and chewing gum. I love it. It's so good.
Yeah. Like the song, like Bill's a smooth style, the whole thing. He's got the boot up on the shoe. This is kind of how Garfield spots him. And this is the moment where I really am like very quickly into this episode, like, God damn, this kid's good. Right. As like, we're just like these close up, this tight framing of Garfield, the like cutting shots, the like staggered editing. He's running across the field. Like it's frantic. It feels so frantic. He is like palpably emoting the kind of terror that like a police officer in this kind of situation would have, especially one from like, you know, fun town America where everything's like nice and hunky dory. We don't lock our doors, you know, like he's so out of his depth and he's like defaulting to his training in this way that is really, I think, like, I don't know, it's evocative. Right. And the two of them uniting is really like magical. It takes the tension like so well and diffuses it into this kind of humor. Right.
Yeah. This is the director for this episode is Courtney Hunt, who is known for Frozen River and The Whole Truth, some of these like smaller films, but she's won some like Sundance Awards. She's known for doing these sort of thriller type shows. And I feel like she does a really good job. She's going to do 3 and 4. These episodes here back to back.
Awesome. That's a great call out. Yeah. It really like struck me, like the cinematography, all of it, the editing, the directing was like excellent through this whole opening scene.
I always wonder too whether like how much Dustin Lance Black is he's the one who took John Krakauer's book and turned it into he writes almost a bunch of the episodes, including teleplay this one. And I wonder like whether this cabin in the woods, like are they just like looking for and they're like, yep, this is it, this is the perfect cabin, or are they like building this I never know. But this cabin is perfectly creepy, just in the middle of the woods. It's perfect for this episode.
As a guy that lives in a cabin in the woods, my cabin is not this horrific looking or dangerous, but it's so great, right? The like old timey captures that like pioneer vibe. I think even at one point they call him, right? They're like, oh, they got a pioneer man, right? But like the gaps in the walls, it feels like rustic, unfinished, dangerous, like all of it, right? It's very scary. It's evocative. Immediately.
If I can find I maybe want something a little nicer than this, and if it could have Wi-Fi, and then for it never to be dark, I would stay in a cabin.
For it never to be dark, you need to go to Alaska. You need to get a little further north there.
Yeah, that's right. Just so I can always make sure there's no like creepy bearded men in the woods.
Yeah.
I have to get a can alarm system going.
That's exactly a lot of string. Yeah.
So this is where we jump back home to Jeb's house. It's the kid's birthday. Becca goes to bring Jeb's mom a piece of cake, Josie, and she's not in the room. So they are going to try, and unfortunately, this is unfortunate. She has dementia, so not a great sign for them not to be able to find Josie in the house.
This is what I like to think of as like what is it? It's Lydia Soprano plotline.
Right? Yeah,
like,
that's right.
Senile mom has like wandered off. We got to find her. Like, it's I guess the Junior Soprano plotline too. Maybe you know, we've lost like the somewhat senile old person that is like part of the cast here. Conflict, crisis. You know.
There was a lot of people at the party. Nobody saw her go out the door. Come on.
Nope. She rolled really well on her stealth check. She like snuck right out that back door, you know.
Probably a disadvantage and still rolled well. So.
Definitely. That's good. Definitely a disadvantage. Yeah.
This is where Bill is going to see, they're going to see this girl run into the forest. Jeb tries to follow her he does a couple times. He plays the distraction well so that somebody else, the police, can grab this girl. Beck is looking around the block for Jeb's mom and can't find her. And so we get this scene back at the cabin where Jeb is going to talk to this girl who you're going to learn is Jenny Lafferty. And this is the scene with Bill and Jeb sitting outside, like singing, was really good. But this is also where I was like, oh, I think Andrew Garfield's a really good actor. Was this scene. He is so the conversation he has with Jenny is so he's so good in this scene, I think.
Yeah, we talk a lot, Grace, and I know you have a storied history as a camp counselor. You spend a lot of time talking to kids. Yes. You are quite adept at this. I am a child language illiterate. I am really not great with children until they can like talk with depth about Star Wars. I'm a little bit lost, you know. So I was very taken by the way he like engages with her. He's like, "Hi, people call me Jeb." So Officer Jeb, Brother Jeb. I like the brother.
I like brother. You know
I like bad. I like that brother. What do they call you? You know, and the kid was striking. Had this perfect capturing between like the makeup and the dirt on her face and the tears, and then the energy of the actual like performer was just so like, again, evocative. Right, you're right there in the van with her. You feel the terror coming off this poor child and the way he's kind of soothing her and easing her and quietly like identifying and extracting the information that he needs. It's excellent. It's an excellent scene between these two. Yep,
it's really good. So we learned that this is Sam and Sarah's kid, and Sam had told her to go pick food with her sister and her mom, but she lost track of them. She doesn't know who's in the fort, and this is where this is the thing that I would not have picked up on. Jeb's like, oh, it's like a fort, like a military fort, like to like protect
where, you know, soldiers people.
And she's like, well, people come and go, the men. And Jeb's like, I met like your Uncle Alan and your Auntie Brenda, and she's like, clearly loves Brenda, which I think is like, you know, from the first scene we saw, she's so good with kids. It's unsurprising that she would have a connection to Auntie Brenda. See, I only saw them on special occasions. And she talks about on there was this day where she wore a black robe. But that was really good in terms of like the show being like anything could be a mystery. And almost immediately in this episode being like, yeah, she was just graduating.
Yeah, it really was excellent, right? Because it creates this ominous thing. You're like, a black robe. All of a sudden your mind is like looking at Brenda like, wait a minute, what else don't we know about Brenda? Maybe she was in on this. Maybe she's getting swept up in the whole thing. Like Alan has said, like she just wanted to get deeper. Oh, no, no. It was the day she graduated. This really makes a lot. It's like her parents had to fly out here. He tried to consolidate everything.
And this is brutal. Sarah is Jenny's mom. Comes up yelling at the car and calling Jenny a liar.
She's a liar.
This is brutal.
Very terrible. This is so tragic, right? As like the radicalized fundamentalist mother comes out to like slag this poor, desperate, like deeply traumatized child in the midst of like what is the crescendo of like a crisis that will inevitably lead her to carry PTSD for the rest of her life. This is really bad. Grace.
It's really bad. I hated it. I hate it. And so this is where we'll get the mention of tares and wheat. Tares all around them, not just the federal government. She's just following Heavenly Father's commands. There's sinners and then there's saints who follow the covenants. And this is, I also love this Bill moment where she's like, Sarah's like, sir, do you like follow all your covenants? And Bill's like, he actually probably does.
It's so good. He's like, you have no idea how annoying it is. You are talking to like one of the good ones.
He's like super devout, ma'am. Like, come on. And then she gets she's like, don't worry. When like, you know, the laminate skin will turn white, which we talked about the laminates, if I'm mispronouncing that, forgive me, but sort of indigenous people and their, you know, how they are written into Mormonism into the Book of Mormon. But this is incredibly racist. Be like, don't worry. When like, you know, when everything comes, all the good Lamanites will turn white. So like, maybe go make sure you're like baptized and you're good to go. Yeah. You know?
There's still time. There's still time. Go hurl yourself into the holy water there.
Brutal.
You know, it's like,
well, racist.
She does like so much so quickly to make you just like loathe her while also being a real point of empathy. Like, I don't know. I could look at this woman and be like, oh my God, this is so tragic, especially with like the kind of mandate, the statement of the episode, right?
Yeah.
Like, as we close and come to the thesis of like what Alan and Jeb end up talking about, like, here's yet another woman who is like imprisoned by this radicalist doctrine to such that her whole worldview is like completely distorted, dysfunctional, and like fueled by racism and misogyny, right?
And she's going to say like, you know, like what the Heavenly Father says, it's very black and white, and Brenda is an ugly shade of gray. forgive me if you listen to me a lot on podcasts, podcast listeners, because you'll probably hear me talking about this a lot, but I feel like there's such a cultural moment thing happening where I actually think, because this is interesting that you say, like, what a vile woman this woman is. And also, like, oh, she just, like, totally ended up in this, like, you know, in this church that, like, is racist and sexist and, you know, all of the things. And I feel like we're having this moment where we're kind of struggling with, I think, the shades of grayness of people in general.
Culturally, as a world, I fundamentally yes. agree. Yeah.
Yes. That, like, I think that the shows that are really resonating in some, that we had this long period of shows like Mad Men, which is a show I love, and Breaking Bad, and Better Call Saul.
The Sopranos. Yeah. I mean, you and I have talked about this, yes. the age of the anti-hero, right?
I think it's yes. going away. I think it's dying, and it will come back at some point. I feel like there's this real lack of appetite at the moment for, like, to explore nuance within people who fundamentally do evil things. Mm-hmm. And this show is choosing to do that. To what extent I think they're going to continue down that path, I think is interesting. Like Robin, I think in this episode is somebody who very clearly, and he's has the beard, but he's not quite Sam levels of, like, seemingly like, there's a list in the Lord, you know, we shall spill blood. Well, he's like, holy crap, they killed like Brenda. Mm-hmm. You know,
he's only in so deep, right? Yeah. I mean, not to diverge too far, but I agree with you. We've discussed this a bit, but we are existing in this time and place where it's harder and harder to, like, tolerate the intolerant and to find, like, engagement there. And it's becoming, like, harder and harder to try to, like, to want to empathize with people that are actively, like, pushing against, like, the betterment that we see in the world, wherever it is that we stand, right? There's such anger and kind of, like, unmanaged kind of hostility, like, brewing amidst us as a culture. It's really tough. There's a lot of, like, tough stuff for us to parse here. And I'm with you. I think that we want, like, a little bit of, like, clarity in what we're exploring here. And I mentioned it kind of last episode, where I think that, like, my takeaway here is, like, this show is a bit of an indictment of the Mormon church, of the Church of Latter-day Saints, as mm-hmm. somebody, like, coming in from the outside. And I think it's important to note that, like, you know, it's a vehicle, it's a television show, not for Mormons, but for everybody, right? I mean, it's out here for folks like us to be drawn into and get, like, a view into this. But fundamentally, yeah. we are talking about, like, radicalization, about fundamentalists, about mm-hmm. what happens when you take your ideology up to 11 and use it to guide, like, every tenet and principle in your life without considering, like, the actual impact on the people around you, right? And the reality of living in a world in a modern day age. So it's very interesting, and I'm with you. I think it's a really interesting thought as we're yeah. exploring under the
bed. I struggled a bit with this idea to say that this is a totally an indictment of Mormonism, but I do think I agree with you. I think it is an indictment of Mormonism. That is not to say it's an indictment of every single Mormon
correct
who exists in the world.
Yes.
And I think, you know, the point about, like, somebody said, like, you know, the Church of Latter-day Saints is inherently sexist, homophobic. You know, there's so many of these religious institutions that the only way for people to, like, move up in them is to, like, assert their power, mm-hmm. and their power, most of these, you know, the people who run these institutions being cis white men. Mm-hmm. And so try to maintain that power structure in these institutions that have a ton of power and control in our society. And so it's an indictment of, I think religion, in a sense, because so many people who move up in religion are fanatics.
Yes.
You know, you don't become the Pope by being like, yeah, I might believe, you know, maybe.
I mean, we start to, like, see it in some of the exploration of Dan as we get, like, a little further into the episode, right? That the time comes where you just activate and begin, like, proselytizing and spewing this message, and people will follow when you speak with conviction like that. Right. It's part of, like, the reflection back on the Joseph Smith in the beginning of all of it, right? And the distinction here. There was another just interesting thought as we're, like, on a tangent for a moment, but in the Discord, in, like, the Under the Banner of Heaven thread, we're having a conversation, and Taylor A had brought up recently Brandon Sanderson is, like, a very prominent fantasy author, an active Mormon. He's part of the Church of Latter-day Saints. We had recently read Mistborn as the most recent book in the PSR book club, one of Sanderson's, like, kind of most famous properties. And no spoilers, but, like, fundamentally the antagonist is a, like, a theocracy worshiping, like, a kind of monotheistic god deity with like this deep lore. And there's a lot of parallels here between like a radicalized theocracy, a radicalized population, and how they're, how you're able to kind of like subjugate the masses who are following this like religious doctrine when the doctrine like consolidates all the power within the hands of one people, you know? And, yes. And that's like very much part of the idea we're exploring here, right? There's a lot of like fascinating, I think, cultural subtext for us to like be looking at the show through. And I think this lens of like, and this line that like she was an ugly shade of gray, it's really powerful and it's very telling as to like part of the way that we're exploring the show. And I think to the idea that you're talking about in terms of like pop culture media and where we're at with the world today.
Yeah. And I'm interested in this show. I mean, this is only the third episode that we're watching. Mm-hmm. How much, you know, and Josh Wigler is a big fan of saying this is like, we don't really know exactly what the show is until you sort of watch it in completion. We're watching along and we get, you know, there's pieces of it that we, it's like a thriller. It's about really, you know, that stuff. But in terms of like the thesis statements that the show wants us to tell, we're only 3 out of 7 of the episodes in. And so I'm interested whether is the thesis statement, these people are some people are inherently good or you're inherently bad, or can religion corrupt you in a way that like can turn you bad? Is that, does Sarah get corrupted by the church, or is she sort of, you know, would have gone along with this ideology no matter where she sort of ended up in her life, you know?
Deeply interesting. Yep.
Yeah. So we're at this like ceremony, which I guess is sort of, I should have done more research into this, Rich, this, the ceremony in which like sort of they're being cleansed and offered up and sort of, and they're joking, and Sarah has a big problem with sort of Diana and Matilda, and Brenda's attitude towards this, this ceremony where they dump like holy water near, very close to my private parts. And Diana says, you know, today is not only about like her commitment to Alan, she's also earning a bunch of new sisters. You know, that's part of what this is about. And this is where Sarah calls her a pretender. Says she's drawn to converts like Diana and Matilda more than real LDS women like Sarah. The only way to forgive a tear is through blood atonement, to cleanse one of their sins by spilling their blood out on the ground.
The whole like opening of blood atonement we'll talk about, but I think that the scene in the church, in the temple as it were, is like so powerful as we're digging in here, and you have such like empathy, they become so like relatable, and as we're kind of like dealing especially like with Sarah, with the way she's looking at this, that this poor woman is like again asserting power, right, in this like patriarchal system where her like entirety is supposed to be like subjugating herself to her like, you know, her priest holder or whatever it is, right, that she like is elevating herself from the others, from her sisters, in the sense that like no, they're pretenders, I'm like a true LDS woman. I don't know, it's very tragic, as we obviously know what's going to happen to poor Brenda here, to like see this moment of like joy, and it humanizes them so powerfully, right? Even like poor Matilda, who's like one of the interesting characters we've really been paying attention to, Grace, like she is like so much like bonding with Diana and Brenda in this moment, and like laughing with them, and like, oh yeah, like it's kind of silly, you know, and it really like humanizes them. It's this thing that would be a ceremony that would be very foreign, I think, for a lot of us to like really imagine and explore the depth of it, and how much of it is hidden, the kind of secrecy and the mysticism that's still like tethered to them, as Diane is noting, like, I thought they didn't tell me either. Yeah. Like, I so thought this isn't an, coming from outside.
This isn't an endowment. It's a two-part ordinance designed for participants to become kings, queens, priests, and priestesses in the afterlife. You take part in a scripted reenactment of the biblical creation and the fall of Adam and Eve. Includes a symbolic washing and anointing, presumably where she says, what's the line here? A woman older than Jesus's sandals just put oil very, very close to my private part. Diana says, yeah, it took me by surprise too. This is an endowment. They're wearing their temple garments, what they wear under their clothing day and night throughout their life. Yeah.
It's a great scene, you know, as we're like going back and we're supposed to really care about Brenda and about what happened here. It's another one of these moments that just humanizes her so powerfully. And like the vibe with her and Diana is very great. It's like an echo of like, you know, kind of Pyrene and Bill and their vibe. They're rootable. You know, you have so much empathy for them.
I'm so nervous though, Rich. We have not seen Ron and Diana in the present day. I'm so nervous. I think that I'm so nervous about Diana.
The heel turn from Diana.
We're getting Sam and Sarah as like these like damn willing to spill blood. I feel like it's all set up to be like, yeah, and then like Ron showed up. Got even worse, you know? I'm so nervous. Yeah.
We will see. I mean, Samuel definitely arrives big here in episode three, right? Yeah. The Culkin, they got their money's worth out of this Culkin, Grace. Yeah.
I know. So through chatting with Sarah, they believe that her sons are in the house, along with, they presume, Sam is in there. And Bill says, like, he's like, I don't know, this is like a bad situation, but like, they're not going to martyr themselves without the press. Like, they are not doing this, like, you know, without attention. That, like, I don't think this is as bad as they're making it out to be. We could probably go in and be fine. And Jeb thinks that they might be begging for bloodshed. And he references the Hans Mill massacre, which is, and then we get flashbacks to it. The governor puts out an extermination order on Mormons in 1838. And we see, you know, these like this crew come and basically execute all the Mormons. This is in Missouri, I believe. And Jeb is wondering, wonder if in Sam's mind, like, we're the militiamen that came and killed all the Mormons. They want a story to tell that, like, we came and we killed them. We shot them and they died and they'll become martyrs. So, again,
I love the way that we're getting this reflection. I like this element of the storytelling. And I can imagine in like a novelization in a literary format that it could work much better, right? Like, mm-hmm. we can take that pivot because we're internalizing all of it, right? It just is jarring, I think, sometimes. But I love to see the way that it's like connecting back and the way that Jeb is bringing this forward. And I think this is a really important moment as he kind of disrobes. He takes the bulletproof vest off and comes to them as brothers, and this access point that he has, the same way that he's able to kind of begin talking to Jenny, the same way he's able to kind of thread himself in with Robin, and like even now to a certain extent, like this coming from inside the church to approach them, because in his own way, like, he's taking a leap of faith, right? And I think that while I keep saying this thing of like, oh, it's an indictment of Mormonism, like, it's not an indictment of all Mormons. Jeb is a great man, right? He's a really good man. This guy's trying to do the best he has, and he's using his faith for strength in this moment, I think, in a really like powerful way to like put faith into like his creator, his religion. His time will come when it's supposed to come. He's doing what's right here. And that he's able to like use that to engage with like these bad faith actors and like put himself in harm's way to protect the rest of his men. He's trying to protect the people inside the building from themselves. Right. And I think it's like, as we extrapolate that out to like literally what he's doing, he's taking this leap of faith. Like, it's very compelling and like really ties with the whole narrative of what we're exploring here in a really great way.
Well, the way he says, like, you know, I want them to think I'm a Mormon before I'm a cop, you know?
Yep.
So he approaches the house unarmed. The man is saying, let my girls go and, you know, turn your men around, get off my land. They're talking about how the leader at Han surrendered, ensuring the future of their faith. This, again, like I said earlier, is kind of a setup, actually. Jeb out front, unarmed, basically then allows the cops to enter the cabin through the back. They find Sam and one of Sam's son. And then there's another person who is able to escape and run out into the woods. So I didn't go back and watch to see if it was anybody that we might recognize, but I feel like there's potential there, I think. Do you have any guesses as who the person who ran out of the cabin might be?
No, so I didn't put a lot of energy there, nor did I go back to rewatch it. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's one of the brothers. I think if it were one of the brothers, that we would have maybe had a little bit more on that moment. Like, it's a flash. This person is gone.
The only one I think it could be, I don't think you put Ron or just from like a storytelling person, like whether this actually, whatever.
Ron,
I don't think it's Ron or Dan, but Jacob, I think, is on the board. I think Jacob running is on the board.
I think that that's super fair, but I also keep going back to these early episodes of Men with Beards. You know what I mean? Like there's an outside factor that we've not been introduced to in the storytelling yet. Like we know it exists because Alan told us it exists and we believe Alan, right? Alan's like actually wants this thing resolved. And so I don't know, like this could be the introduction of like one of these outside agents, but I didn't put a lot of like thought into it as I was just like, well, okay, like a loose end, a thread for us.
I mean, I said we're pretty early into it. We're also like the middle of next episode is halfway through the series.
I know. We're almost halfway done. Yeah, I'm really loving the show, right?
Like, I'm really loving it.
Again, I didn't realize like kind of what I was stepping into as we dove into it. I knew it would be interesting. And I certainly love Garfield, but I'm like, I'm very like caught up in it now. Yeah.
The Cat Who Hates Mondays. You said you love Garfield.
Yeah, and lasagna. No spiders, though. Yeah. I had a cat named Nermal once, so I don't know, he would hold it against me.
No, I agree. And I the same thing with the black robe thing. And then they like the black robe thing is so fun because they like do it in the same episode. Then they're like, you immediately realize it's graduation. And this loose end, they don't. So, I think a good mystery show will answer questions along the way while then asking more questions. And this is like, yeah, who ran out of the cabin? I think it's a fun question. So
I'm with you. I think it's like really important, right? That some of the questions are being answered up. So you can kind of lose track of like what we're asking even. And also there's not this sense of like everything coming rushing in at the end and like drowning in like information, right? Like, yes, they're doing a really great job of like playing with the mysteries, resolving some of them as we go. And like the rate of learning that we're getting, I really feel like each episode covers a lot of ground. It like is very much advancing the story forward.
I think that has to be the case in a detective show as well. Like if the detective is never figuring stuff out, like what are we doing? You're a bad detective, you know?
Yeah, but that's true. That's true.
If Bill and Jeb can like follow a lead and get to the cabin and they found the cabin, like that feels like good detective work. And it feels like, okay, I'm with you. I think I'm with you on this journey of trying to figure it out. You know, his crisis can be thinking about his own faith rather than like being unable to solve the mystery of what's happened.
Yep.
Well, I think a big answer on the board we get is Sam and where Sam and his involvement in this whole thing, which is very much involved. But let's take a quick commercial break. We come back. We'll chat through the rest of the episode.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So before we get to Sam, actually, we do find Josie. She was on a bus and she was trying to head to where she grew up. And the bus driver recognized her from work. So this is kind of, this is sad. Dementia's sad. It sucks.
It's very sad. I went through this with my grandmother, and I was the kind of ground zero person, like you know, there as a caretaker. And it's a really, really tough thing to experience on both parts, right? Yeah. I like empathize with it so powerfully because of my personal experience. And like, it's tragic that Jeb's trying to like hold on to this thing. But I think this is another really great moment about the power of community and the value of the church and the fact that like this kind of bus driver does this thing. There is strength to all of it. Even it was like small. Right. But as Jeb like had called somebody early on when he's like, oh, I'm not going to be able to make it to the party. Right. Like these moments are great. And it is showing the value of like what a congregation together can like offer each other and what a community is worth to like an individual. And but it's very sad. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's a good point. The bus driver knowing her from church and showing that sense of community. Yeah. So there's I think like sort of a social worker chatting with Jenny saying, you know, don't worry, your family is okay. Asked her how she helped her dad. She said she would pick vegetables and berries, but just don't let the bad people see you. Who are the bad people? They are all people with uniforms. And she says, you gotta let my dad go. He's not the leader. And Jeb asks, well, who is the leader? Jenny says, well, Heavenly Father chooses the leader. And so we get this flashback of Eamon returning and not being too thrilled with Dan's leadership while he was gone.
Yeah, this is all wild. This whole scene in the parking lot, right? Because like the Lafferty's are so menacing, these brothers, right? And I think you said it early on of like Wyatt as like playing this Dan character is like quirky, you know, but like he's very dangerous and disgusting. Like we hate him. I hate him. But, but he is like in this moment, like, oh God, it's so sad. You know, it's like so sad. And again, it's one of these things where like hurt people, you know, and like, how does somebody get to a place of being this kind of dysfunctional and unmoored in the world to like do this much damage? And like, I don't know, man, it really is like very interesting the way this all plays out. Eamon like coming back, flipping out on them. Dan has clearly like dropped the ball badly and needs to be dealt with. But like just before his brother's wedding in the parking lot in front of the children, we're going to
be just married on the car.
Yeah. We're going to like take the belt and like whip your hands until you bleed, right? And Ron in this moment becomes so rootable as he is like this defensive protector, not in front of the kids. There's children here, right? But like we're also getting that undercurrent of like, yeah, Ron's really dangerous, you know. Like Ron is like no joke, and like Ron is a powerful force, a powerful individual, but like a powerful force in the family. And Eamon like facing that the way that like he squares up, you know, let's saddle this like Lafferty man, you know,
oh my, the, like, ridiculous, what an old timey like, boxer he looks
cartoonish
like.
Punching stance, you know what I mean?
His like, hands, his fists are a foot apart.
He's ready to fight Popeye right there, Grace.
I love it. You know what I mean? Let's do this.
Get me my spinach, boys. You know,
like, so hilarious. I mean, it's sad as well that he's like, yeah, in front of all their like his grandkids and whatever. But I think this is, you know, we saw the scene, I think it's in episode one, where you get Ron, Eamon yelling at Ron from a distance. And you can just feel the tension bumming up, and that, you know, we're talking a lot about like, you know, there's been in multiple episodes, like there can only be one patriarch. There can only be one leader of the family that comes up here again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's becoming a little bit clear how perhaps Eamon loses that position as the leader. Interestingly, though, I think there's sort of this like, you know, going to be this, Dan has set them on this path of like, you know, don't pay a license fee, or it's you're binding yourself to an agreement to the government. They're telling Alan not to pay his traffic tickets, you know, and they're all like, Brenda Later is just going to be like, is there a way we could do this without all getting arrested? Like that would, you know, let's try that, you know? And, but you can say, I mean, again, I think the show is setting us up with like, it seems like Dan is going to be the one who like leads them down this path. But ultimately I have to think it's going to be Ron who is looming in the background, as you know, in the flashbacks, and we're not seeing in the present day. I have to think he's like he's the big bad.
A lot of work here, Grace.
He's like, almost like the monster that, you know, it's like the monster we're not seeing, but we've also seen. Jaws, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. He is like the big bad. He's very dangerous. We know he's in the water, but like we don't see very much of him. You know what I mean? Yeah. He's circling the boat here as like Dan's chumming the waters. Like it's dangerous, you know? And and like the casting is doing a lot of work for me, right? The like meta read of like you got Sam Worthington here. Like he's a powerful performer, man, right? Like in the scenes that Ron is in, like he really carries a lot of weight. He's got this incredible presence and I'm very curious to see where we're going here as well. It's like we move past the seat, this conflict in the parking lot. Like this is a real powder keg that we're dealing with now.
I guess also the other thing is like Dan is such a goof in the sense of like he's got his hands like and he's like, what a thing, what a day. Like,
oh heck, you know, it's okay. It's okay. Let's just get back to painting, finish up, you know.
I'm just waiting for Ron to come in and just be like, he's smart enough, like come on. Let's go do a murder, you know?
Like, as much as we talked about the moment of, like, Abba and Pyrie behind the cabin, the interrogation with the little girl, like, these were really good scenes. I loved, like, the whole framing of that opening. But this is the scene to me where I'm like, gosh, this is a really good show. Yeah. Because we're dealing with, like, a really tragic moment here. But there's levity in it, in Dan, in, like, the ridiculousness of Dan and the conflict. Like, the way he's trying to diffuse the tension for these children and, like, his goofiness. And there's this danger that's happening with Ron while we're also, like, oh, thank God Ron is there, right? Imagine if Ron's not in the scene while also conveying to us, like, Ron is dangerous, you know? And this old man, look at, like, this daft, like, crazy, like, disgusting old man, what he has done to these people, right?
Heyman like, also, like, wanting to fight his child and then be like, all right, well, you walk away and you count to 10 just like I thought you. Like,
you want to hurt me, don't you? But there's, like, there's a mutual pride and contempt that's coming from Heyman when he's, like getting ready to fight Ron and like, oh, you want to hurt me, you know, the like lingering shot of like throwing the belt down in the parking lot. And like the two of them do walk away together. They walk away together. Right.
He does. And then he's like, you count to 10 and walk away. And then Diana meets Ron and they walk together. Yeah.
It's just a lot. Like I thought it was a very excellent scene in terms of like moving the story forward, doing a lot for the characters and just being like, goddamn, so compelling to watch.
Yeah, and then we cut to the scene with Dan, and they're in the room with Matilda and the girls, and they're playing, and then they're going to pray, and eventually leads to Dan basically like repeating over and over again, and the rest of them joining in is, I will do anything and go anywhere, which he just repeats over and over and over again, and he's like praising the Lord. So, yeah, I think Dan's losing his mind a little bit.
Yeah, Wyatt Russell very evocatively capturing the insanity acting as he's like getting into his crazy chant at the end. I will go anywhere. I will do anything. You know, I hear you, Heavenly Father. Like, it's intense, man. It's like, oh my God. This is like a person going crazy as like this little girl watches out the window. Like, oh no.
Yeah. So back in present day, the pirates are going to go see a bishop and it's time for the two girls to have their baptism because it's implied that I guess the youngest one is 8 so that they can both have their baptism. And the bishop tells them, you know, all your old sins will be washed away when you're baptized and any new sins that you have from here on out will be yours to repent. But I just have two questions for you. First, have you given your tithe with 10% of all your allowance, earnings, gifts you give to the church? And they both say yes. And also just, do you believe that this is the one true church? And they both say yes. And he actually one at a time, please don't be influenced by your siblings, even though this is very much us peer pressuring you.
The only one who's allowed to influence you here is me.
And the Lord.
The overwhelming like weight and mass of this church behind me. So,
just one at a time, please. We'll peer pressure you one at a time. They say yes. And so then they head out, but Jeb stays behind, and Jeb wants to talk to the bishop about his mom. And this is where he brings up the thing where she said, you know, she had this moment of clarity where she doesn't want to be here anymore. And he says, he says, with all that pain, what do I do? And he says, if you would do anything in any way to abbreviate a life is to interfere with God's plan. This is a trial to be overcome. Try medication. All right. Yeah. So yeah.
Women are known to like struggle more with emotions. It's just also, I hate this guy, right? Like you hate this guy by the time you leave. He's horrible. This is again where like I do have to say, like, it's pretty tough, right? This is like a moderate here that we're dealing with. This is not a radicalized figure in the LDS community. This is like the advocate, the kind of avatar for the temple itself. First of all, to like the 10-year-old children, like, okay, have you been giving away like your gifts and your property? Are you 100%. Like funding the mega bureaucracy, you know, because we need that money, we need that sweet sweet money to like lobby for stuff, and like, so that's rough, don't feel great about that. Then we like shift into this whole discussion of euthanasia and this man who's like struggling for some support, you know, from his faith, from his like clergy here, that like he's not gonna go to a shrink, he's gonna go to the bishop first, and they're like, yeah dude, you know, put her on meds, but like, nope, you can't do anything, like, sorry. It's just all very bad, into like the closing like overwhelming statements of like, yeah, systemic misogyny, like, you should have control, like, you know, treat the females in your life like property, like, it's disgusting, and like leaves such a bad taste in your mouth, right?
Also, he's like, Jeb is just like, just very quickly as well, like, this woman who's very much into the Church of Latter-day Saints just said like that people who sin have to like atone with blood.
Can I just get a little TLDR on that?
He's just like, yeah, the prophet will never lead you astray, so don't worry.
Questions on a shelf, brother Pyrie, right? This is the big takeaway from the scene. Like, fundamentally, we're like beginning this like real wall of misinformation of like, no, we have to think about the church interests. That doesn't feel great. And the bishop feels like a jerk, and all the pressure around the kids and the refusal to acknowledge like this, these taboo discourse about the past, even when it's like concerning like a murder investigation in the moment, like, this, none of this is great, right? And all of this, like, I do feel like really leaves us with like a little bit of vindication for this journey that Jeb is on. Like, the crisis of faith to me as it like exists here, this is the moment of like the hammer dropping against the chisel and fractures like kind of spider webbing around the shell of faith that Jeb has, right? Where like we've been tapping a little bit so far, like this is the first like boom where I feel like, yeah, you can really feel the like commitment falling away as he's leaving the space.
Well, yeah, so he's talking with Becca, and he's like, he's worried about putting her on medication because he believes that his mom certainly is struggling, but also has these moments of extreme clarity, he says. And he's worried that putting her on medication means there'll be none of those moments of clarity. And Becca's basically saying, like, this is a small time in which you have to deal with this until you'll be with her when you die. You both will be perfect and fully healthy forever, you know, in the afterlife. This is the thing you were talking about. The church really plays on this a fair amount, this idea, and it's certainly, I can see the appeal of it, that this, you have to struggle for a short time here, but then you'll get to spend eternity together. So
it's a powerful tool, and like has been in like many organized religions, certainly the Christian ones, as we like go back and look, this notion of like buying your way into the afterlife through action in this life, through money, through all of these various commitments you make to the church. And it's like a, you know, impossible thing to overcome in a world with like uncertainty as to what comes when we lose those people that we love most dearly in this life. A promise of like eternity with them is very tempting, it's very powerful, and it's a great motivator, you know. And again and again and again, it's like my like you know, minimal research into like better understanding the Mormon church as we're getting into this, is the like, this is the primary tool that is used to manipulate and encourage most of the participants of the church to behave in certain ways, to like, don't ask those questions, get in line, do the thing, pay the tithe. Like, it comes back again and again and again and again and again to like, but don't you want to spend eternity with your loved ones? Oh, you don't? Oh, well, you'll be alone then forever a half, and then again.
And so Jeb is thinking, can we just postpone the baptisms? I'm kind of involved in this murder investigation, and it's a big deal. And she says, no, like, people will think the girls failed their interview, it'll be humiliating for all of us. And she kind of like goes into bed, and Jeb sort of like stares at her. And this is, I feel like this is my favorite scene between them so far, which is you know, she's like, listen, I acknowledge that you're like the man of the house, but also don't forget that I choose when and if I will ever hold your priesthood again. Yeah, and put a little wink. It's cute. It's good. It's good.
It's fantastic. Again, it does a lot of stuff. I think as we talk about like him and Taba, it feels like a real relationship. You know what I mean? It feels real, feels lived in. And this feels like a married couple, right? Especially when we're, I don't mean to like be using these words, but like to be coming in from the outside, like it's a little alien, right? Their culture is like alien to me. I'm unfamiliar with it. The way by which they live is not the typical. This isn't like, you know, the Wonder Years or like your typical kind of sitcom mom and dad as we look into this LDS household, right? And this part of it is so normalized and so like, yeah, we get it, right? At the end of the day, like there's still a man and a woman living here in the North American continent trying to get through their days. And like this kind of stuff is funny between them. I just thought the note here that like ultimately he's using the tools of this religion that he's questioning to like gain control, to like gain the upper hand in this like back and forth with his wife and be like, no, the decision's made, which he can only do because of this faith that he's questioning, right? Yeah. And it is like it's this interesting juxtaposition, I think, as we're examining the Lafferty's and like the overarching theme of like what we choose to take from these religions, when and where it works for us and when and where it doesn't. Do you know what I mean?
And also this, like this, you know, her basically like this wink at the end is like, you know, Alan says to him, you know, like, you think it's, I can't remember what he says in a previous episode, but something like, do you think a woman should be able to do that? He's like, yeah, of course. And he's like, well, then you might not be a good, you might not be a good Mormon as you think, you know? And I feel like this relationship here, like Jeb is pretty devout, you know, Bill saying like, he's good. He's good to go. He does his covenants, you know, he's good. But also like there's ways in which like he clearly is not like fully in line with every, you know, he's not full, you know, like even if they're just sort of joking here, like, you know, he clearly respects her, I think, more than what you would, what Alan is saying most to the by the book Mormons, would think how your relationship should be with your wife.
I love this idea that you're talking about here, Grace, because like it's kind of hard to like put your finger on it or give it like the one kind of like label, right? But like it is that this, like, you know, he is a good Mormon, he's a good parishioner, he's a good churchgoer, but there's a disconnect where like there's this sense that he realizes like some of this stuff is a little antiquated, right? Like some of it just is what it is, and like we're not going to push back against it because that's not the kind of people we are, whatever. Like you do what you got to do, but like behind closed doors we all know like it's a little silly, right? Like in the same way they're making fun of like the ceremony before the wedding and like the woman older than Jesus's sandal with the oil in my private parts, right? That like even the best of us, of the people within this like faith, are able to acknowledge like some of this is a little silly, right? You know, and it's like very humanizing, and I think it's very real, and I think that it's very emblematic of a lot of people that are part of like a lot of groups in the world, right? And as we're able to kind of casually be like, well, that's just how it is. Like, yeah, we know it's silly and it doesn't make sense, but it's not a big deal. So like, just get over it.
My parents are Presbyterian. They do like, there's like communion as part of that with like, you know, like the grape, you know, the grape, the bread and the
Christ,
And it's just like, we all know this. So that's a little silly. Like, I'm so sorry if that's offensive to anybody, but like, you know, like, eat the body and blood of Christ. It's like, it's just bread and grape juice. I don't know.
No shade to anybody, right? Of course. Yeah. I don't think you do either. Like, anybody who's here listening to us with powerful faith, faith is like really powerful and really important and really valuable. And like, there's a lot of good stuff that could come out of it, but a lot of, I think it's beyond even just religions. Like, there are practices for these organizations that we've been part of for a long time.
True.
You and I play a bunch of D&D, Grace, and there's certain things that like, it's ridiculous. Why does this work this way? Because it just always has, And like, there is a reluctance, I think, sometimes from inside the system to want to change it, which is another like thing that we talk about a lot today in the modern world, right? Of like, well, why do we need to change it? Like, who cares? Who's it hurting? But at the same time, like, it doesn't quite fit, does it? And like, actually, it does hurt some people, maybe, just because it's not like hurting you and you're able to make light of it. So I think it's like a really great little acknowledgement that we're getting here that gets echoed in the wedding scene and in the ceremony in this like marriage scene. And it's important to note that like, Jeb doesn't just toe the line, right? Like,
I mean, Sam's entire thing, he talks about like she's a fornicator and they're like, sleeping outside the marriage. Like, no, she didn't listen to her husband, you know? And like, certainly, I think if like Sam watched Jeb and his wife, he'd be like, I think we should postpone the baptism. She's like, no, I don't think so. Like, he would be like, you fornicator. You're not
blood atonement. Yeah. Piracy.
Your husband wants to postpone the baptism. You know, like you have to listen to your husband. That's what Sam would say. So yeah, it's just this a little beat that I think works really well.
Agreed.
So Sam is I think he's getting like his fingerprints. They're like doing intake, and he's like just shouting like biblical phrases and like, you know, just like different things. And Jeb goes to see Alan. I was really glad we got some more Alan in this episode. I think he's been really great. Alan asks if Sam had anything to do with it. And then Jeb brings up Alan's police record, which we find out he was arrested the day after the wedding and was held in contempt. He recorded the judge while he was, in court, which is a pretty big no-no. And Alan said, I didn't really think it was consequential. He says, well, if you're hiding this, who else could you be protecting? He says, well, okay, here's what happened. I planned the wedding the day before she was graduating so that her family could attend both events, the wedding and the graduation ceremony. He was on her way to buy flowers, and his brothers had told him not to pay his traffic tickets, his traffic fines. So he was arrested for outstanding traffic tickets. And Brenda was angry that he had put his brothers ahead of her. And so she confronted the family.
Yeah, I mean, it's all like pretty straightforward. I love the Alan and Jeb together. You know, Jeb's got this thing like for one second, Alan. I thought we were on the same page. Mm-hmm. Why aren't you telling me things, you know? And as I go back to that first episode of like the performance, you know, Alan's he's like dealing with a lot. He's dealing with a lot, this poor guy, right? And you can now begin to empathize with like how he's like not noting important things. There's so much stuff. You live a whole life. Like, how can you know necessarily the relevant stuff? But yeah, we're beginning to like get the understanding of like how Dan is like sweeping all of them up into this crazy idea, and like it's bleeding over now into Alan's life, right?
Yeah. So we get this meeting with Brenda confronting Dan, being like, you know, and Dan being like, you know, we're not going to pay taxes. It's like an unlawful rule, you know, or we need to break unlawful rules. And she says, does it scare you? He, this is very interesting here because she's like talking about, you know, doing what Eamon wants. And
she's like, your dad got him that truck. They've impounded his truck. Like he just did, your dad gave it to him. Yeah.
And he's like, does it scare you more to disappoint Eamon or me? Like, you know, it's
or
very
us. And I think it's really like noteworthy. Robin is like looming in the background of the scene. Mm-hmm. Robin kind of like standing behind her, giving the like, like, you know, the quiet nods to Dan of affirmation as she's like very reasonably challenging this whole plan. This is the whole like, do we have to all go to jail, though? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I get it, Dan. We all respect you. We respect you, Big Dan, but like, do we have to go to jail?
That's where he says obeying unholy laws for daddy's sake will not make anyone happy. And this is where Dan reveals his big plan. Don't worry, I'm gonna run to be sheriff, and then we'll make the laws, and you know, I'll be the court, basically.
Dan will have more power than any judge, and it's so great because he's like, I'm gonna run for office, and they're like, what office? Sheriff. And she's like, sheriff of what? Like, there is this quiet contempt and like disdain. Like, Brenda's the only kind of grown-up here who gets that, like we're in the basement of the Lafferty household playing make-believe, like Dan's got his shit together, but this guy is a mess. And if you people think that like just because he's decided to run for sheriff and had this dream that it's gonna happen, then you're all like so whacked. Like, I get all of that from this line read of like, for what, in these two words, you know. Brenda like just continuing to be so compelling, and
it still is wild to me how many things in America you guys elect. Like, the sheriff being elected to me just seems wild to me. Like, coroners being elected is a thing I don't really understand.
It's crazy. It's wild. We are all about democracy. We just don't like it when it works well.
You know? I think the other notable thing in this scene is Sam getting, this is the first time we see sort of flashbacky Sam getting pretty like, you know, you need to honor your priesthood. Like, you know, cause she's like something like, I know you didn't ask me or something. He's like, yeah, we didn't. Like, nobody asked you.
That's
you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And like just the callback, because like some of the brothers are not as developed, right? And like Sam being the one that like as soon as Aben's gone, like, all right, boys, house is ours, make me dinner, woman. You know, we get the notion that like Samuel is like, waiting for an excuse to burst through the seams. You know what I mean? He like seems like amongst the more volatile of them and like pushing, you know, he's got this like, he's going to follow his family where they take him. But like the justification for him to go full unhinged, like, yeah, it seemed like a fit real well for Samuel.
It's funny. I wonder how much this, you know, whether the show will be pretty rewarding on a rewatch in terms of, we've talked about these people who like the way they're setting up Ron and the way I think Ron is going to turn out to be. And then Eamon is really interesting, I think, in terms of somebody who he's the head of this like Lafferty family. It seems to be like incredibly powerful, the Kennedys of Utah, you know, whatever. And you think he's going to be sort of this like supremely evil guy. And I think he's being set up a little bit to like not be in that, but like lose control of the family in some sense and potentially not be alive anymore. But there's this moment when we first meet Sam, where Sam's kind of like acting up and Eamon's like, hey, you have the barbecue to attend. Like, you know, in a way that I think shows like, I think Eamon knows his children very well, actually.
Yeah, agreed.
In a way that like Eamon might not be a good guy, but he kind of knows who his children.
I agree very strongly. I think that like, you know, the family, like Eamon clearly is able to manipulate them very effectively. He's created this like group of people that are fervent and dogmatic in the system, right? And like I think you're right in the same way he's noting with Ron, like, oh, you're angry again, you gotta count to 10. You want to hurt me, don't you? Count right. to 10 right. like I taught you. You know, he's got this quiet control and power, and I think that slipping away is like, you know, very evident. I'm curious how deeply we explore that.
Yeah. Dan says he's running for sheriff because Joseph Smith ran for president, which correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not a, you know, I didn't study American history in university, but I don't think Joseph Smith was the president of the United States. And so interesting to be like, well, he ran for president.
No, he definitely lost. Yeah.
He definitely lost. Yep. Yeah. But Dan is following in his footsteps. He'll get rid of the 16th Amendment and actually anything after 10 can go. And but it's like, so just like slavery is the 13th Amendment is going to go. And they're like, no answer.
Yeah, they can't even like address it.
Yeah. This is where she says, crazy if you ask me. And Sam says, yeah, we didn't ask you. Alan says Brenda was trying to protect him from going astray. Sometimes their wives see their husbands much clearer than they can see themselves. And Jeb agrees.
Yeah, I mean, it's the ultimate echo, you know, as we're like coming back to like this moment and Jeb is like reflecting on this like strain with his family and him like asserting his control over his wife because of like, you know, the bullshit tenets of like their religion and the fact that like she strongly disagrees, but is going to like follow the line because that's how what she's supposed to do. The stuff with him and Alan is like really great. Alan, like really compelling. All this like revisiting of Brenda is like, oh my God. Like, you know, how could she be the only one in the room who can like see clearly through what's happening here? Right.
Yeah. So we get another flashback. We're talking about Alan is explaining, you know, it was Emma, Joseph's wife, knew Joseph pretty well, too. And we're sort of watching the scene about Joseph wanting to sort of strengthen the army so that the army is worthy of the Heavenly Father. Let their blood spill, not Mormon blood. It sounds like they assassinate the governor of Missouri, although in my research, I feel like this is a failed assassination attempt, but the show makes it seem like he very clearly gets shot. But whether he dies or not,
I did not do my deep homework here, right? I didn't actually go digging around and looking, so I'm curious.
Lilburn Boggs is the governor of Missouri in 1842, which would line up with, we're talking about 1838 before, so you could sense that this could make sense. He does get like shot in the head, but he does survive. He two bullets in his skull, a third in his neck, and one in his throat, which he swallowed. It was severely injured, but he lived.
What a badass. This guy caught four bullets in his head, and then he lived.
Yeah. It sounds fake, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's in the wake of the Mormon war. He's the one who put out the Missouri executive order. So, you know, exterminating all the Mormons. So maybe not like, you know, a badass in terms of getting shot, but in terms of like his moral competence, you know, whatever, you know.
Yeah. I have not done enough history.
You're going to get, I don't want you to get canceled about your takes on Lilburn Boggs.
Yeah, my Lilburn Boggs love. I'm just saying he had a high constitution score. That guy had a lot of hit points to get shot in the head that much. That's clearly right. A bad guy. He issued Missouri Executive Order 44.
No, I know.
extermination order. This guy's basically Palpatine. What's happening here? This is very bad.
To be fair, actually, the fact that he got shot four times and didn't die, that's actually very Palpatine.
He is Palpatine. I'm sorry, guys. Obi-Wan, like, coming soon on the horizon. Star Wars on the brain. Please forgive me.
So Alan says, Alan's like, I think they got you. Like, how high up does this go? Like, does it go to the White House? Did they ask you to put your questions on the shelf? And Jeb asks, did you ever do anything to try and heal the rift between Brenda and your brothers? He says, yeah, I wanted Brenda to be happy. So I offered this significant sacrifice. I believe what they're saying is they're like, they would sort of leave the Lafferty family, but he would like Brenda not to take this news job. And they would have a bunch of children, and maybe after the children, she can go and, you know, be a news anchor. He says more children would make them holy, but it was just another surrender offered. He was just building her a new cage, a cave, a prison. Powerful
it's
stuff here.
So tragic. And I mean, here's the thesis of, like, I think this episode is, we're talking about the way that the Mormon theology and the doctrine of the Church of Latter-day Saints empowers this, like, patriarchal bullshit and, like, completely disenfranchises women. I think that the term, like, in the marriage ceremony is, like, agency, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, oh, what agency? You know, like, oh, well, our free agency as people, right? Brenda is, like, this avatar for a more modern of the 1980s, like, Mormon woman who is educated and has a career and, like, thinking, right? And the way that this comes to a head, I think it's so sad because Alan has such love for this woman, and he's so powerful in the way that he's expressing that to Jeb, and he's expressing his affection for the things about her that rubbed the more conservative members of his family in the church wrong, were things that he admired, respected, and loved about her. And in his mind, he is making the sacrifice. He's saying, like, hey, I'll do like Ron. We'll go our own way. We'll step away from the family. And it evokes, like, what he was talking about of, like, I thought I met her family. I thought, like, we could fit in there maybe, right? But at the same time, he's saying, like, all I need for you too is insert, like, Robin's kind of inception of his mind from before. All I need from you two is abandon your career and give me many children, you know, like, be a good church wife. And it's, like, very tragic and sad. And we see from Brenda, like, she loves this man. She's a really, like, loving, kind person. She loves children. She wants a family. She believes in, like, a lot of the values of the church, not the crazy radicalized shit that
she says earlier. She says, why can't I have a career and children? Like, I'll have my career and then I'll have children and I'll have everything. I'll have it all.
And this is where, like, Alan is sad almost, right? Because he, like, very naively is, like, repeating back this stuff that Robin told him. He was like, no, you can. After you have the children, you always have your degree. You could go back and be a newscaster, as though, like, you know, that's an option. And there's a huge distinction here. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Grace, but especially in the context of, like, the early 1980s as a woman trying to, like, come up in a male dominated field, the distinction between, like, being a 23-year-old fresh out of college, bright-eyed, like, cheery-faced young lady, and, like, oh yeah, I'm 35 with 37 Mormon children, you know what I mean? Like, this is really tough, and, like, a very fucked up thing that he's asking, right?
Yeah. Like, he's saying, I don't think he, or maybe he does believe it, and that's the sad part, but, like, yeah, there's, like, our effed up society, it would be incredibly hard to, like, after you have children, start your broadcasting career, you know, especially, you know, like TV, you know, that's all about, like, you know, that, you know, you're going to put this, So
40 years ago too, you know, I, again, like, I'm maybe giving him more credit than it's worth. I find him, like, the performance is so, like, engenders so much empathy from me. Right. That I, like, want to be like, he is a little naive. I do think, like,
I think Alan, so too.
Like, right. Yeah. Like, compared to the rest of his brothers, like, he's, you know, buying what? In on this.
Again, I go back to, like, Eamon knows his kids, right? Mm-hmm. And he's the one being like, you know, yeah, you got to, like, get your stuff together a little bit, Alan, you know, like that before.
You got a lot on your hands. Yeah.
You got a lot on your hands. Yeah. I think also, like, this idea of, like, the, you know, the new prison, the new cage, the idea again, Rich, that it's, like, it's family. The thing that he wants Brenda to is family, which then will be the thing at the end of the episode when she's like, we need the family to stay together. We need to keep family. If I'm part of your family, especially I have a kid, we need to keep all of that connected, is the thing that ends up, like, binding her seemingly further into, like, wanting to maintain some relationship with these people who I think someone out of this family is going to end up killing her, you know?
It's an incredibly powerful tool, the use of family. I mean, like time and time again across organized religion, like fundamentally the people that you have around you in your life and your day to day, the people that raise you, that you love, that you're most devoted to, you'll move heaven and earth for them, right? Like agnostic, religious, whatever you may be, the like investments we develop in one another is like community and individuals, families are powerful, powerful bonds. And it's an incredibly formidable tool to use to manipulate people. And it's really tragic as we're looking at the collapse of like this family in the midst of, you know, their radicalization. It's really sad. It's a really sad story.
So we get Sam being interviewed by both Jeb and Bill. He says he was there to separate the wheat from the tares. Bill is like, you would cut the throat of a 15 month old baby. He says, I was just sent to spill the blood of those on the list. And this is where Jeb's like, wait, the list? Who else is on the list? What's up?
Jeb is so good at parsing. Like, okay, this guy's saying a bunch of crazy stuff. Same with the kid and the fort. Like, keywords. Like, Jeb is dropping in on these important notes. Soldiers, fort, list. Oh, you have an actual list.
And he's like, well, you know, fornicator Brenda and her rotten fruit spawn Erica were on the list, which is like absolutely disgusting. Bill's like, so Brenda like slept with someone else. And I feel like for such a serious show, starting with such subject matter, the like tonal shift of Sam and like the Culkin here playing, like immediately being, they're like, he's like, no, she didn't sleep with anybody. What the hell are you talking? Like, no.
Yeah, like, he gets totally, like all upset. He gets even like, more mad. Like, you're not wait, even understanding. She did what?
Yeah. He's like, no, she didn't listen to her husband. That's how she's a fornicator. And they're just like, I was like, you ever heard that term? Like, that's the definition. He's like, no. And then the other thing that Sam can say, he's a destroying angel. And Jeb's, who are the other destroying angels? Like, ask God. He's like, do you know where like Ron, Dan, and Jacob are? He's like, ask God.
Ask ye not of me.
Yeah.
The line deliveries here are so crazy. I do love the like twist here, the like slight play again. It's like this way that like we're like diffusing the tension. There is this like clear injection of levity in like his read of this moment, but it's also like a revelation to us as like that's not what's happening here. No. Right? It's such a mislead.
Well, like, also because earlier there's like, you know, she was in love with Ron, Dan picks the ladybug, you know, and I think here we're getting like, no, this was not. You know, at least did not result in like, you know, someone fawning over someone else. This is only about control and power over another individual, which sometimes people, you know, use sexual means to do that, but that's not what this is. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. I think, it's really important as we're like getting clarity on this question that we've been moving forward with. But the performance from Samuel here, the like Culkin, like it's huge, man, you know, especially because like the distinction, the level of change, like Robin was, you know, we'd seen a bit of him in the past and we see him now like in this modern iteration and he's got the beard and he's a little bit more intense and aggressive, but it's not such a stark evolution. Whereas like the Samuel of that barbecue scene and the man who is in the litigation room, it's like whoa. This is like a huge amount of change that has occurred. It might even be not that like far in terms of ideologically, but in terms of his willingness to like confidently put out this version of himself and like embody this kind of insane prophet vibe, like
and admitting to, I mean, like he never says he did the murder, but he's very like, it's fine. Like,
oh yeah, this is like the shift into like radicalized terrorist of like, no, we actively want to take responsibility for these actions because like they were done with intent and like clear intent and purpose, and they were very pre-planned and conspiracy. Like he's giving up so much legal stuff here for them, right? This is like the beginning of building like a real case towards one of the Lafferty's, right?
There's also that when they asked like you know, where Ron, Dan, and Jacob, and like, are they okay or were they on the list too? And he's like, I don't know, the list is God determines the list.
Yeah. God made the list. How am I supposed to know how dang long he wants it to be? Yeah.
How many people in the list? I don't know. It's God's list. I don't know.
I love these notes too. There's a point where he I think it's that line where he looks at Jeb. He's like, no, idiot. Jeb's like, what about your list? And he's like, no, idiot. I don't know how dang long God wants it to be. And even in his fury, he is breathing fire and spitting venom at these heathens in this room, right?
And he's saying, I did God's work. I don't need your love, Jeb. I have God's love.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Yeah. I just love that he has to even to the good Mormonism, he manages his language, and he only is gonna call the guy an idiot. He's only gonna say dang this. But it's a level of crazy that it's being captured in a very, very powerful way.
Yeah. Really good. Right. And so then we cut to Robin, who we learned last episode. He's very surprised that Brenda and the baby are dead. And so he slams on the door and he wants confirmation. He says, I don't know what you're doing to Sam in there. He's being tricked because of his mental state. None of what he's saying will hold up anyway. And this is where Bill comes back in with the photos and shows Robin that the kids are dead. And Jeb actually is before they show the picture, this is a masterful performance you're pulling. The pretending not to know what happened. You're doing a very good job, Robin.
Jeb managing his anger through all of this, as we got that first moment of Jeb walking into the house and being completely overwhelmed by the intensity of this murder scene. And now we're evolving into the spaces where there are moments he's getting very angry at these men. Mm-hmm. And he's got to manage that. Right. I really love it. And Robin, screaming at them as Samuel's going full tilt and Robin's Pyrie, get in here. Is that true? Is that true? Are my sister-in-law, my niece dead, right? And now Taba's going to be the hard cop and show him the pictures. And Jeb is just dude, if you are pulling my leg here, this is a masterful performance. But I think there's a level of, I think this is the we're kind of moving forward 1, 2, 3 here as we've now got the third Lafferty brother in police custody. And it seems pretty clear Robin was not in on whatever happened here, right?
Well, he tries to stab his hand as soon as he sees the pictures. And then he says, I don't think Sam could have done it. And so Jeb says, he said there's a list. Can you tell me who would be on the list? And so Robin gives up these names, says the Lowe's. And the other one I couldn't quite, the Stowe's?
The Lowe's and the Stowe's, correct. Yeah.
The bishop and the state president and their wives and family. They are ones who they tried to intervene. So, Jeb and Bill are going to go try to make sure that those folks are okay because they would be on the list of people that the Lafferty's perhaps would want murdered. And so, I mean, it's so funny because I'm most of the time, I don't believe everything I'm seeing. But with Alan and Robin and this Sam, everything I'm seeing in the police custody, I think I'm buying what people are telling me so far. Maybe there's going to be something that the rug gets pulled out from me. But I believe Alan's not involved. I think Robin's involved. And I think probably Robin, why do they have him saying, I don't think Sam would have done it? I think if Sam does it,
I think the important note about what's happening in the police custody is that I'm with you. I believe everything that they're offering. I think they're not offering everything they have, right? I think all three of them are holding back various pieces. Samuel, least right. So in his fervent radicalism. Robin, less so now that he is really understanding the context of what's happening around them. And Alan, just overwhelmed, right? Alan, trying desperately to reconcile what's happening here. And but I'm with you. I think fundamentally the show is teaching us to believe these three. All right.
And again, I think it's you need Jeb and Bill to be good detectives. So if they're bad, if I think something could happen where I think your point about they're not telling everything. And I think something could be a lie in what if anyone is saying at some point. Again, I've offered up this theory that I could kind of see that Alan did it just not as much under his own doing as the show would make you believe at the beginning that this is some domestic incident, more that he's literally held at gunpoint to kill his wife. That's the length I go. Yep. But with Robin here, I think that the piece of information, again, I'm so hung up. We have not seen, as they say, Dan, Jacob, Ron, that the reason why Robin can say, well, I don't think Sam did it is because Robin will know the hierarchy of the men in the woods, right?
Yeah, he absolutely would. Yeah. And I mean, we still have this other like brother in Jacob, right? Like who killed the squirrels early on. And
I really hope it's not Jacob.
I hope it's not either, but I do think that it's important to note that there's like a player in the mix here who like, you know, yeah, is also there. There's a lot of other brothers on the field, right?
Doesn't this family feel like a family that would say it's Jacob so that Jacob like, they would absolutely just throw Jacob under the bus, and because he would get the least sent, right?
If he's some like, of them, yeah, for sure. Yeah. When you're talking about the guy who's like, I'm gonna run for sheriff so I can get around the laws and we can like reinstitute slavery, and the other guy who's like, I'm gonna pay off the building inspector so we could just like build my pool and like what, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, yes, you know.
So, the last piece of the episode is Alan then talking again. He's just repeating the line about I built her a new cage, a new prison. And so we see Brenda talking on the phone saying she heard the whispering of the spirit and she feels pressed to keep the family together, to fight for each member's exaltation, no matter what it takes. And she'll need Diana's help to get them off of this wicked path.
After she got pregnant, her heart changed shape, right? And, you know, he's talking about this notion of her being less invested in pushing back against like the radicalization and like withdrawing away from the family and more trying to like bridge the gap and heal the wounds, right? And it's very tragic, man. It's really like very, very sad. And it's a very poignant message that Alan is like reflecting back to this man who is doubting his entire connection to his church, to like his faith, and expressing that in terms of like not wanting to just fully throw his daughters into the system that is going to like encourage them to overlook their education and their careers for the sake of like following and adhering to a man who will hold their priesthood and producing many children for him, right? This is like a really tangible thing, but ultimately like forced to use that same patriarchal control system to like tell his wife no and like keep the children safe from this machine. It's all very poetic. It's very powerful. And the way that they were able to articulate the theme through like the storytelling, the rest of the episode, the reflection, the recounting, all the way back to the Joseph Smith of it all, and then like really give you this mission statement thesis at the end from Alan here. It's pretty well done. You know, I'm loving like how as each individual episode of Under the Banner of Heaven is done, I have a clear vision of like this episode's theme. And while it's simultaneously moving this big mystery forward, right?
Yeah, I thought a really good episode. I think like the A plot stuff is by far the best stuff.
It's great.
I think that like the stuff with like his mom, you know, it's obviously like a tool about his, you know, his crisis of faith. So I feel like, you know, again, this is 3 out of the 7 episodes. So I don't want to slack on it too much. I don't even think it's that bad. And I really like the scene with them and how that plays into his, you know, his larger story of like how he's viewing himself as whether he's a good religious man. I think that like there's some of the flashback stuff. Like, why did we, you know, I'm sure it's coming, but this like them assassinating the Missouri governor, like that whole thing, like, you know, about how his wife was the one who I don't really even understand. And again, maybe there's more to come in the next episode or a future episode that will like shed light on why that's in here. But I feel like that's the weaker stuff, and everything else is like so tremendous. It's such a well-acted show. I think the story is really captivating. I'm so interested in, I'm liking getting a view into this world, and, you know, being along the ride to try and figure out like what happened to Brenda here. I think it's been paced really well through 3 episodes as well.
Yeah, I can't overstate it. I mean, the performances are great. I think the writing is strong. I don't think that like the home stuff is bad at all, to echo your point. I think the other stuff is just like so good that's not as exciting. And like some of the flashbacks I think are much better than others of the like Joseph Smith stuff, right?
I like the catch me on the PSR out of context Twitter. I really like the Hans Mill massacre.
Oh yeah, I love that massacre. I love that as well. Big fan of that massacre. Grace, yeah, so, it's one of my favorite ones. Yeah,
that scene, and I think it works. I think because what they're trying, right? They're always trying to like use
mirror
that story
the
as
present.
A metaphor or whatever. Yep. And that is like, yeah, we're feeling prosecuted. You know, the idea in that moment where he's like, I want them to see me as a Mormon and not a cop. They're gonna see me as the militiaman. Like that stuff worked really well.
For yeah, me, like so. Their leader walked away to carry the faithful. forward so you could be here today. All that stuff was great. I was going to say, like, I think that the issue is it feels like they have like a mandatory like check off of like, we got to get a couple of these in every episode, right? The second one, just like, it wasn't as strong, right? And like, did it really need to be there? Like, they thought it did, but I don't know that it like added that much. Whereas the first one I thought was really strong.
Rich, so, I think perhaps you and I, you're notorious for running the book clubs here on PSR. I think perhaps once we wrap this show up, there might be the world in which you and I go away for a little bit, read a book called
Under
the
Banner of Heaven,
and then come back with our comparisons to the show. I would like to do that with Shining Girls as well, another show that I'm covering that's based on a book. So, yeah.
I've been dying to read that book, and I haven't watched the show yet because I haven't read the book. And I'm like, I got order of operations, Grace. Nonetheless, episode 3, really good. I'm very excited for episode 4. This is an excellent TV show. You know, I think it's very, very good. The minor criticisms, like aside, like it's really firing on every cylinder for me. And I'm finding like it's really much filling a space for me as like a spiritual successor to True Detective, as somebody that doesn't love a mystery show, but like love the character stuff that we got in that like investigative show. Like, it's really great TV.
Yeah, I agree. All right, well, this is so fun. What else are you up to? Where can people find you, Rich?
We have a bunch of things going on. So Star Wars is coming. May is nearly over, but Obi-Wan's just about to get started. So Mike and LaTanya and myself will begin podcasting about that beginning at the end of the month here. Of course, as always, you can find me on Twitter at DM Philly. I discovered Twitter was hiding a bunch of my DM notifications, so I just found a bunch of messages from folks. Hit me up there if you want to talk about Under the Banner of Heaven, or Star Wars, or tabletop role-playing games, which is one of my favorite things. And you can find me playing those games with Grace and a bunch of our friends at Post Show Recaps over at twitch.tv/DM Philly. Most Tuesday nights, we are there playing Dragonfly, where we play D&D in space. And Grace's character is actually a religious character who's great. Yeah. She's a bit of a prophet herself.
Love turtles. Yeah.
Yep. We have an awesome time this Sunday, May 29th. I will be back with my with Threads in the Pattern, episode 3. It's our Wheel of Time role-playing game show. Yeah. I've got a great cast of people telling the story in the Wheel of Time universe. That's mostly what I've got going on. Yeah.
Cool. I'm doing stuff over here this week. Errol and I will be back with our coverage, our movie coverage. We're covering Firestarter, another book that was adapted into a movie, and then in 1984, and then remade. Not really sure why they remade it, but that's okay. Errol and I will chat about it. Shining Girls every week with Melissa and Amanda. The doctors are in the house, and I get to join them along for the ride. I was on a couple episodes of Candy, the Hulu murder crime show as well, starring Jessica Biel, Melanie Linsky. So check that out. Over on Rob Has a Podcast, cover sports with the Off Speed Podcast. I think it's most of what I got going on. If I missed anything, on Twitter at High From Grace, I will let you know about it. We'll be back with episode 4, Church and State, Rich. It's the next episode of Under the Banner of Heaven.
Keep them separate, please. Keep them separate. Yeah.
I think Dan will try to do differently, but we will see next time we come back for another episode of Under the Banner of Heaven. Until then, bye-bye.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.